Funding for the Think podcast comes from TCU, exploring renewable and sustainable energy sources to power a clean energy future. Stories of research can be found at endeavors.tcu.edu. Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
It's called the Malthusian catastrophe, that moment that looms somewhere in the future when a growing population's hunger surpasses our capacity for food production, not just in some parts of the world, but everywhere. Malthus thought it might happen in the 19th century, predicting widespread famine and conflict and ultimately a decline in human population. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. The predictions of Thomas Robert Malthus have not come to fruition yet due to improvements in crop yields and food preservation and distribution. But with global population north of 7.3 billion people, depleted water tables, soil erosion, and even farmland taking up for growing biofuels rather than food calories, many experts are concerned the thing Malthus was actually wrong about was simply the timing. Those same experts say it may be possible to prevent global famine, but only if we act quickly. Journalist Joel K. Bourne Jr. is a contributing writer for National Geographic. His new book is called The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. Joel, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
You write that the world is running out of food, which in a nation of plenty like the U.S. is an easy truth to overlook. But there have already been shortages in other parts of the world that have triggered panic, have triggered violence.
That's right. The food crisis that occurred around the world in 2008, really through 2012, we had consecutive food crises that caused food riots around the world. And, you know, in the United States, we almost didn't even notice because we pay so little attention, so small a percentage of our annual income to food, maybe 10 to 14%. But in the vast majority of the world, where they pay 50 to 60% of their total income for food, anytime the price of basic staples like corn, wheat, or rice go up, they feel the pinch. And in 2008, the price of wheat and corn tripled. The price of rice almost went fivefold. It was an enormous stress on many of the poorest of the poor around the world.
The crisis over wheat came to a head in Egypt. How did a country that once exported wheat find itself at the mercy of rising prices abroad?
Well, you know, Egypt is the most wheat-dependent country in the world. They eat more wheat per capita than any other country. And yet they're incredibly dependent on imports from the United States, places like Ukraine, in order to keep their people fed. Now, in the late, say, 1960s, 1970s, they were able to produce enough wheat to feed themselves. But their population tripled since then, and their farmers just have not been able to keep up. And so they are utterly dependent on the world grain markets to buy the wheat they need to feed everyone.
Is there any reason to believe, Joel, that in future food crises, the United States will continue to be spared?
Well, the last three, you know, two years of drought we had in 2012, 2013, were a real wake-up call, I think, for the United States as well. Those two droughts cost us $30 billion in crop losses and affected about half of the world's, half of the United States farmland. So as climate change starts to bear down on us and we start to feel the impacts and the breadbaskets here in the Midwest, we will feel it as well, mostly due to high prices. And we're already starting to see that in sort of high meat prices that we're starting to see at the grocery store right now.
We should talk about Malthus here. What convinced him that the world was in imminent danger, and what did he fail to predict as he was making his really dire calculations for what the world might have in its immediate future?
Sure. Well, you know, everybody likes to think that Malthus predicted that we were going to run out of food at the end of the world and we'd all fall off some big precipice and famine would incur afterward. That was actually the neo-Malthusians that were predicting that in the 1960s. What Malthus said back in, you know, was it 1798, was that there was this constant stress, this constant check on population from available food supplies, but it also could be from real wages. Anything that prevented people from having children, whether it was delaying their marriage until they could afford to feed a, you know, support a family, or more proactive things like disease, death, wars that would contribute to population decline. All of these things would have an impact. Now, Malthus was kind of pushed to the side thanks to, first, the great British agricultural revolution that occurred in the 1800s about the same time as the Industrial Revolution. They went hand in hand. So at the same time, the British landed aristocracy was enclosing the commons, putting more land in productivity, and starting to use things like seed drills and more mechanization, as well as different types of fertilizer, really boosting English agricultural production and also putting enormous amount of peasants off the land and into the cities and the new factories. So all these things created an abundance of food and a growing population in England. And luckily, the Industrial Revolution soaked up all the excess labor. So Malthus's most dramatic concerns were sort of put aside. Others have raised the concern again. In 1900, another British father of chemistry said, we're going to run out of nitrogen fertilizer, and we're not going to have enough to grow wheat for all the wheat-eating people of the world. And of course, 15 years later, two German chemists came up with a way to fix nitrogen from the atmosphere. So suddenly we had a chemical process to create unlimited amounts of nitrogen fertilizer that, again, assuaged the fears of these people who were starting to see the limits of agricultural productivity.
Here's a stark fact from the book. Every year, we have 80 million additional mouths to feed on this planet. By mid-century, that will equal the equivalent of one more China or India at the table.
Yeah, that's this is the sad reality. And again, what we're looking at is this constant struggle between supply and demand. And, you know, currently we have about 800 million people on the planet who don't get enough calories to have a healthy life, a healthy lifestyle. And those are the ones we focus on. Those are the ones we consider to be starving. But what we don't often pay attention to is the 2 billion others who don't get enough nutrients to have healthful lives. And that contributes to stunting. It contributes to the primary cause of the global burden of disease. This hidden hunger is an equally challenging problem because it means these people have shorter lifespans. They have greater sickness and death, and they're not as productive as they could be. So even though the number of actual famished people who don't get enough calories has been slowly declining, the number of people who aren't getting the nutrients they need has been increasing. And again, this creates a staggering problem as population increases and as we start to eat more grain-concentrated foods like meat and dairy.
You talk about our move to the cities, and we know that the way we grow food and distribute food has changed a lot, the way that the economy trades food has changed a lot. There's also the reality that there are a lot of places that could be growing their own food that, for economic reasons, market reasons, are not doing so.
That's right. There have been several examples of this. And of course, that was the great idea behind globalization. Each country should produce what it does best, and they should, you know, buy from the world market what they don't produce. Unfortunately, when you're a small country, one example I write in the book about is Haiti. You know, Haiti once had the capacity to grow enough rice for its entire population. That was during the 1980s. But when we restored Aristide to power in the early 90s, one of the conditions was that they dropped their trade barriers to U.S. rice. And so suddenly we had this highly subsidized rice being shipped en masse into Haiti and completely wiped out the market for Haitian rice. And suddenly here's the poorest country in the Northern Hemisphere dependent on world grain prices to feed everyone, dependent on the world grain market. And, of course, when the prices of rice went up fivefold in 2008 and suddenly people couldn't feed their families, that's when the riots began. And so, again, this lost capacity to produce the basic staple of a country's was incredibly important in its political situation there.
So we owe just about every bite we have ever taken to the work of agronomists, despite the fact that I think a lot of us don't fully understand what an agronomist does. Can you explain this to us?
Sure. I get this question a lot when people ask me, you know, what you studied in school, and I say agronomy. I just typically get these blank stares. But at the school that I attended, which was NC State University in the early 1980s, it was considered sort of a combination of plant science and soil science geared toward row crop production. So really, we're talking about production agriculture, both the art and science of growing these staple crops that we all depend upon.
How did you move from that into journalism?
Well, you know, I graduated in the 1985 in the middle of the farm crisis. The Green Revolution that was started by Norman Borlaug in the 1960s and 70s reached its greatest fruition in the United States, of course, in the 70s and 80s when the farmers then were told to plant fence row to fence row. The United States was going to feed the world. You know, we were going to flex our agricultural muscle. And, of course, what that did was cause grain prices just to plummet. And Willie Nelson and John Cougar started doing farm aid the same year I graduated from college. So, to me, it did not look like a promising career. And I had been working as journalist on campus, writing pieces for the campus paper. And I thought, well, this journalism thing looks kind of fun. Maybe I'll give that a go. And here I am, you know, 30-some-odd years later, still at it.
So Borlaug had some really interesting ideas, and you can't really call him a controversial figure today, but the things he did to increase crop yields and that he encouraged farmers to experiment with certainly have had both positive and negative consequences.
They have indeed. The Green Revolution, of course, was the greatest increase in agricultural production that the world has ever seen. In a short order of about 40 years, this new type of agriculture, which depended on high-yielding varieties of seeds, high loads of fertilizer and chemical pesticides to protect these dense monocrops, and lest we forget, most people do, is irrigation water, was critical to the Green Revolution. These three elements in the new type of agriculture that Borlaug helped develop was just unbelievable. We went from an era around the early 1960s when about a third of the world was chronically hungry, to a period now where maybe 13% of the world's population stays chronically hungry. But the downside of that was an incredible impact on environment, especially our water table, our water usage. We now, you know, have Roundup in our rain. You know, we've used so much chemical pesticides to grow our own food. It's an endemic water pollutant in nearly all our water basins. And so much fertilizer is flowing down the Mississippi River, it produces a dead zone the size of New Jersey or Connecticut every year in the Gulf of Mexico. And this is not just in the United States. This is happening all around the world. Millions upon millions of hectares of ocean that have such low oxygen that nothing can persist in them. So the Green Revolution, while it did great benefit for feeding a lot of people and decreased poverty in many parts of the world because it made food so cheap, has had an enormous toll on the environment, one that we can't sustain. And that's why, as I write in the book, agriculture has to change. We don't have the luxury of doing it the way we've been doing it for the last 40 years.
And another hard limit that we come up against is water. We know that underground water resources are dwindling in many parts of the world. And, of course, a lot of water used in irrigation ultimately is inadvertently wasted. It doesn't fall on the crops it's supposed to water.
That's right. Just like energy, we're incredibly wasteful with the water we use. Only about half of the irrigation water ever gets to the root zone and is utilized by the crop. And that's pretty good, you know, in terms of our traditional types of irrigation. But we're currently, you know, in a place where about a billion people are in areas where water is scarce. And within the next decade, another 2 billion people will live in those areas. And water is becoming increasingly problematic. According to the World Bank, we're already expropriating more water than we can sustain, 20 to 30% more. So, again, this is an area that's quite problematic.
Journalist Joel K. Bourne Jr. is my guest. He's a contributing writer for National Geographic and has just published a book called The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Joel K. Born, a contributing writer for National Geographic, whose book is called The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. Join us at 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Joel, as you said, of course, the population is growing, and we will talk about that this hour. But as people are moving to cities and they are more densely populated, how is it that we are losing so much land that otherwise would be suitable for farming?
Well, it's interesting. Some studies have projected we lose as many as 30 million hectares a year to both development and things like desalinization or desertification, where once fertile and arable land is simply taken out of production. Now, that's about roughly the size of the Philippines that is no longer available to us to grow our food on every year, which makes it incredibly difficult for the remaining farmers and the remaining producers to keep up. So unless we want to start taking down tropical rainforest or savannas, which we, in terms of climate change, we really shouldn't do, it's going to be very difficult to keep increasing yields on the same amount of land that we currently produce on, or even less land as the future goes on. And even Borlaug said in 1970 that the Green Revolution advances will only give us about 30 years breathing room until we can get these powers of supply and demand back in balance. And sure enough, around 2000, the great yield growth that we saw during the Green Revolution began to plateau. And so we've had no real yield gains in rice or wheat in the world's grain baskets for almost a decade. Very problematic in terms of producing more food on the same amount of land as we go forward.
Here's an interesting problem. We have made progress in reducing global poverty, but we know meat consumption tracks closely with national wealth. Getting one's calories from meat typically has a much larger footprint because you first need to raise and feed the animal, often with crops that could otherwise be eaten directly by humans. How much of a problem is meat consumption in the world?
Well, this is one of the growing problems that we're going to have to address sooner or later. I mean, is this rapidly rising meat addiction? And I talk about it in terms of China. Now, China has doubled its meat consumption over the last decade. Even though they're far below the average amount of meat consumption in places like the United States and Europe. But still, just because there are so many Chinese moving from the rural areas into the cities to work at the factories where they're guaranteed a certain amount of meat each day is putting an enormous amount of stress on the world's grain systems, because China can no longer, after being sort of proudly self-sufficient in grain for decades, China can no longer grow enough grain to feed both its people and it's 600 million hogs. So they have to import that feed, and most of it's coming from Brazil. So this huge soy revolution that we've seen go on in Brazil and Argentina over the last two decades is primarily driven by increasing demand for pig feed in China. And so this is having an enormous effect. And of course, as you mentioned, I think pigs, it takes five times the amount of grain to get the same amount of calories out of pork as it does just eating the grain itself. 10 times if we're talking about grain, fat, and beef. And of course, you're in Texas, so that's a very
touchy subject.
Touchy subject there. But again, the grain density of meat, as well as the water density, the inherent energy contained in growing meat is a grave concern. And it's one of those things that even as people get richer and we want them to eat better diets, producing those diets is going to be a great challenge.
How sustainable are meat calories, if you want to call it that, from seafood as compared to land-based meat?
Well, I just did a story a few months ago on aquaculture for the National Geographic and the new types of aquaculture. And almost every food researcher out there, organizations who's looked at this issue, just points to aquaculture as the most efficient way to produce animal protein. You don't need fresh water. You don't need fertilizer. If you're growing fish that are not carnivorous, you don't need fish species to feed them. So it's just an incredible efficient, sort of like 1 pound of feed in gets about 1 pound, maybe a little bit more out of fish protein. And again, since fish are living in a buoyant environment, they don't have to grow big, heavy bones. They can really pack this fairly healthy protein on quite well and make it very affordable for people.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak now to Andy in Dallas. Hi, Andy.
Hi. Is there a such thing like an optimal population number for people to live somewhere between sufficiency and abundance and be able to do all the work in the country and defend it? For example, I think that number for Egypt is 15 million, and if Egypt now is 100 million, how do we go down? And what would that number be for the USA if such a number exists?
Wow, that's a great question, Andy. There have been a lot of discussion about carrying capacity over the last few years, basically since the 1960s when we started to have our first fear of running out of food in modern history. And, of course, we currently produce enough food to feed 9 billion people adequately, a fairly low, mostly vegetarian diet. The problem is it's just not distributed well. Most of the calories are produced in areas where we eat too much of it, and far fewer produced in areas in Africa and South Asia that need it the most. But one of the solutions that we talk about in the end of the book, and the book is really set up, the first half sort of putting together the problem and the second half looking at ways we can get around it, is again trying to help many of these countries that are having very high birth rates, very high fertility rates, make the demographic transition to having, instead of for women having 6 or 7 children during their lifetimes, having only 2 or 3. And the key to that, of course, is education and giving them the political and social freedoms that we enjoy here in the United States and in Europe. Educating women to at least the 6th grade, hopefully even higher, as I've suggested in the book, would be the best thing we could do, both to ease food security concerns, but also, to enable what many have called a pink revolution, where women's rights are respected and women can fulfill their ultimate promise. So I think there are many ways we can do that. I don't know if there is a particular number of an adequate number for a population. I think that would be very hard to hold a country to.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll take another call now, this one from Gary in Irving. Hey, Gary.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Hunger, and extend this to diseases, we know that people in certain parts of the world are having to eat all kinds of animals. Shouldn't we all be concerned about diseases and pandemics from hunger?
Wow, that's a great point, Gary. And yeah, the hunger basically is these hidden hungers that I was discussing earlier, these lack of nutrient or nutrient deficiencies, according to the World Health Organization, are the primary cause of the underlying burden of disease. Now, we're not talking about pandemics here. We're talking about clean water, fresh water, diarrhea in kids, things that they get from eating poor foods that aren't healthful for them. And again, this is part of the deal that increases the high level of childhood mortality, which also spurs people to have more children and create greater demand. The best thing we could do in many of these countries is to eliminate that burden of disease so that we have greater child survivability. And therefore, there won't be such pressure among parents to have 6, 7, 8, or 9 children. But as supplies get tight, we live in a global environment. Right now we're looking at this rare wheat rust disease that's hopscotching from Africa into the Middle East. And, it's only a matter of time before it's going to get in these great grain belts in Russia and Kazakhstan and Asia. And certainly disease can travel the same way.
Depending on where they were located, farmers for a very long time have made decisions about producing food crops or producing crops like cotton or tobacco, things that can be profitable but don't put food in anyone's mouths. Now there is the competition between food and biofuels. How tempting is it for farmers to make the switch?
Well, for farmers, biofuels is the best thing that could have happened to them in the last decade. I mean, my wife's family farms in Nebraska. They've been looking at $2, $2.25 corn for the last since the mid-1980s. And suddenly the biofuel decades comes on, and corn is hitting $6, $7, $8 a bushel. I mean, it's just, it's a wonderful windfall. The impact of that, however, is that we're now pouring 30 to 40% of our corn crop into our vehicles every year. And this is enough to feed everyone in Africa for a year. So it's, it becomes a moral dilemma. And we're not alone. I mean, Europe's doing the same thing with biodiesel made from soy and rapeseed and sunflower. So, you know, all this prime agricultural land tied up to creating a fuel for our vehicles, which we can fuel with other things, electricity or whatever, is one of the things that is extremely problematic. And we could immediately free up a lot of arable land, millions upon millions of hectares, if we stop these biofuel mandates that have been imposed by mostly governments, government who thought they were doing well. I mean, it ended up being just another subsidy to already heavily subsidized farmers.
You know, this, Joel, really takes us to why this whole situation is so vexing, because there are different parties who feel like they're doing the right thing. You know, I might think it's most important to grow food that everyone can afford and that we can distribute. You might think it's really important to, you know, grow biofuels so that we have sustainable fuel sources. The problem is, do we have to agree as a society, as a world, in order to take steps forward in any direction to solve these problems? Or can there be lots of different people? Do you understand the nature of the question? Can there be people making different choices?
Well, and this is part of the thing that I think I tried to write the book to help people understand, because we're so far removed from agriculture now. You know, when my dad was a kid, a third of Americans either worked on a farm, lived on a farm, or were related to a farmer. Hmm. And now, you know, it's only 2% of the population. And of course, farmers, like journalists, follow the money. If there's money to be made in a particular crop, they're going to grow it. One of the great, you know, interesting things about the organic agriculture movement is that the organic farmers are making more money acre per acre. They're making more money, and therefore you see more and more people feeding that market desire. But the governments have an enormous role to play, because that's where they put the subsidies. It's where they want the farmers to grow. Now, if you're a poor farmer in India and you can get a, you know, somewhat decent market price for lentils at the market, then you're going to grow lentils. But if the government comes and says, we're going to give you a support price to grow rice every year, and it's going to be a price you can make money at, they're going to grow rice every year. So it's really both what we desire as consumers and how we want our future plate as well as our future farms to look, and how much we can influence our government to put our subsidies and point them in the direction of a healthful, you know, carbon sequestering agriculture instead of what we've got now, which is essentially a polluting type of agriculture that grows a lot of yellow stuff and is doing a lot of environmental as well as climate damage.
Barbara writes in from Arlington wanting to know if we can feed 9 billion people, which is, you know, where the predictions of population growth ultimately top out, with organic techniques. Is that possible?
Well, you know, this was the challenge when I was at NC State in ag school. I would ask my professors, and this was steeped in green revolution agriculture was what I was trained in. And my advisors would always say, hey, organic is great for your garden, but it'll never feed the world. That was the sort of easy, you know, easy answer to all my questions about organic. But what we found out now through many studies, many long-term studies, is that there is typically a yield penalty with organic, but it's not very much. And it typically occurs in some of the most productive grain baskets of the world. Like corn in the Midwest, organic's not going to be conventional. But tomatoes or other types of fruits and vegetables, organic's right up there with them. And they typically will yield, you know, within 10 or 20%. The yield gap is much lower than people think. The problem with organic and with conventional is that neither of them are, at this point, capable of dealing with the climate that we see coming down the pike. And that's the real challenge. Both of them are going to have to change. And what I suggest is sort of a blend of both best techniques, the best agronomy from their organic growers who really focus on soil fertility and soil carbon, and maybe, you know, the best seeds we can get from the conventional growers, and sort of blending, creating a blending of techniques that really give us the most bang for the buck. Because if we continue going along the climate path we're on right now, a broad review of climate studies done by the Royal Society a few years ago said that if we hit a four degree increase Celsius in global average surface temperatures, we could stand to lose half of our agricultural land, making it either less productive or non-productive at all. And that's at the end of the century when our population is supposed to hit 11 billion. So unless we can somehow either develop a climate-smart agriculture or dramatically reduce our emissions fairly quickly, it's going to be very hard to meet these challenges.
All right, let's hold hands and jump onto the third rail here. Should that blend that includes the best seeds include genetically modified seeds?
Well, you know, I've got a whole chapter on GMOs in the book where I discuss the issue. And I'm a bit of a pragmatist on this. Like when I was at NC State, these things were going to solve all our problems. We were going to wipe out disease by creating plants that, you know, and foods that carried sort of vaccines and produced these vaccines. You know, we're going to wipe out this hidden hunger by creating plants that carried vitamin A, vitamin C, vitamin D. And, you know, and none of it's happened. You know, here we are 30 years later, the same amount of time it took Borlaug using conventional methods to triple world grain production. We've got two blockbuster GMO traits that have done a little good, have not done too much harm, but overall are somewhat underwhelming. And thanks to the way we've managed them in the field, the resistance of Roundup-resistant plant weeds and BT-resistant insects is threatening to wipe out all the benefits that we've accrued from these things. So on the other hand, though, the technology is getting so cheap and the threats against us are so high, I don't think there's any way we can just sort of take that technology and put it aside and say, no, we're not going to use that. We're going to hold our nose and try to be purists about it. Because researchers are now using the technology to create crops that have sincere benefits for humankind. And I think we're going to need them.
We're speaking with journalist Joel K. Bourne, Jr. about his new book, The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. Join the conversation at 800-933-5372. Find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is Joel K. Bourne. His new book is called The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. Joel, what can we learn by observing what you called the Malawi miracle?
Well, Malawi is an interesting country. It's one of these chronically food insecure, landlocked countries in sub-Saharan Africa where the population is on track to double or triple within this century. And you know, many people have focused on Malawi as sort of a laboratory. You know, if we can make it work in Malawi, we can make it work throughout sub-Saharan Africa. So there are two programs that I profile in the book. One is the Millennium Villages Project, which is being promoted by Jeffrey Sachs at Columbia, Pedro Sanchez there at Columbia, and is part of the big Millennium Development Goals Initiative. And in that one, they're basically using all they can muster in terms of money, green revolution techniques, high-yielding seeds, donated fertilizer, all these things to try to boost productivity. And it's very expensive. It has worked to a certain extent to help alleviate food security problems. But the problem there is it's also so costly that very few people believe it's sustainable in the long run, unless all the donor nations of the world start ponying up to do that type of development in sub-Saharan Africa. Now, the other one we look at is one based more on agroecology, where researchers from Canada went in and tried to help these young farmers, mostly women, plant varied crops, you know, intersperse legumes that would help bring nitrogen into the soil, incorporate the residue to bring more organic matter in the soil. And they had almost identical increases in food productivity as well as food security using this much less expensive type of agriculture. So again, looking how these two played out and deciding, you know, which one we can afford to do or which one they can afford to do. And really, you know, this is up to the African people as well, the Malawian people, which one that they most would want to try to implement. Because really, this is not something that people from the United States or experts from here can force on anyone in Africa. The Africans are very proud. They are very hardworking farmers. They've got a tough road ahead of them because their soils are often very poor. But they will figure it out. We just need to help them figure out the way that works best for them.
Back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. We have Voon on the line in Aspen. Hi, Voon.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yes, my question is, have you looked into Joel Salatin at Palisades Farm and how his practices might solve a lot of the problems that you brought up? Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks, Voon. Yeah, Joel Salatin is one of the one of these interesting guys who is trying to develop a new type of agriculture on his farm, he's very focused on sort of the agricultural sort of agroecology element of food production. And I do talk about that, not him in particular in the farm or his methodology, because there are several people out there who have their own techniques that they're promoting, but we do look at agroecological. Things like the system of rice intensification, which is a program that was developed in Madagascar that has shown to double, sometimes even triple, rice production with half the water and half the fertilizer, if any at all. And again, there are many types of agriculture can utilize this, from potatoes to lentils. Wheat can even be grown this way. When you saw that being utilized in India, there was a young farmer in a very poor part of India that actually shattered the world rice record that was held by a very prominent Chinese rice researcher a few years ago, using this type of technology that sort of combines the best of both high-yielding seeds, but this sort of more organic-oriented agroecological type of agronomy. And it's inspiring to see how well it can work when it works together.
I think the figure you cited in the book was that it's estimated that a third of what we produce, of the food calories we produce, are either discarded, spoiled, or eaten by pests instead of being eaten by humans. What do we do about food waste?
Yeah, food waste is a huge issue, and it's one of the things that it's like low-hanging fruit. We can, even though it's not all that easy to eliminate as you would think it would be, it is really something we can go after and do something about. And, you know, it's a third of all the food is wasted, and as much as half of all meat and vegetables, which are very grain, water, and energy intensive. Now, in Western countries or in the developed world, it's mostly post-consumer waste, right? We're putting too much on our plates, we're not eating it, and we're throwing it away. And that is just a change in habit that we have to overcome. In the developing world, it's before it hits the farm gate. So we're seeing things rot in the field because they don't have storage capability like we have in the United States or in Europe. So for them, and it's much more critical because they're so much more dependent on the production of their land, incredibly important that we help them create good storage capacity, ways to get their crops to market that work for them. And that way it would make much more food more available for them much quicker. So again, there are a lot of good people who are working on this, and hopefully we'll come up with a solution to that very soon. But showing a little self-restraint in the Western world is certainly what I suggest, as well as eating a little bit lower on the food chain.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Barbara is on the line now in Arlington. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. I called to ask if you can speak to how important it is to leave some small part of land uncultivated, especially in a landscape that's becoming more and more and more a monoculture. I'm from a farm family in Iowa. We're trying to manage together a farm that we've had in the family since 1866. And, a discussion we're having is whether or not all the land needs to be plowed, I'm arguing that it's priceless to keep some portion of the land to preserve populations of insects, native pollinators, songbirds, and we don't even know what we might be saving. But it really worries me that the landscape in the Midwest is becoming more and more a monoculture.
That's a really interesting dilemma. Thanks so much for your call, Barbara.
Boy, Barbara's exactly right. And, of course, as the biofuel decade made corn more and more profitable, we saw enormous amounts, millions of acres of former set-aside land that were in the Conservation Reserve Program administered by USDA come out of production. And these were often highly erodible lands. They were wetlands that were immediately put back in corn just so farmers could reap those high prices. Now, what Barbara is talking about is incredibly important. And, you know, it's an economic issue for many farmers because they don't want to leave anything fallow that could be growing food. However, we're finding more and more that these refugia for both, you know, as you mentioned, pollinators, but also things that might not make me harbor sort of resistance for these genetically altered crops, weeds, insects, so that we won't lose the ability to use BT in our crops is also incredibly important as well to creating these harbors that allow native wildlife to flourish and native plants and insects. Pollinators, of course, is key. Pollinators have been, you know, we've been inundated with stories about the bees and how important they are to our food system. And without them, where would we be, which would be in a very difficult position. So creating refugia and making farms both food producers and habitat, I think, is very important. I think Barbara's onto something.
Here's a question from Justin via Twitter. Justin writes, farmers and ranchers often say they are the best stewards of the land. Would you agree?
You know, I learned everything I know about conservation from farmers, ranchers, and hunters and fishermen, believe it or not, who had a vested interest in keeping their farms productive. But I think, as in my case, my personal case, my father took all of his information about managing the farm from the local university and the local ag advisor. And if he's not getting good information about stewardship, about what the best things to do on his land, then they're not going to be the best stewards. And so I think we've done our farmers a disservice over the years by making it both our land-grant universities and our ag extension services sort of just extensions of the chemical companies that are trying to sell our farmers the latest, greatest weed killer or pesticide. So in that case, I don't think that they have been the greatest stewards. And of course, if you just look at what modern agriculture has done to our watersheds, as well as our wildlife, I think you can, you know, the data is there to justify that. However, I don't diminish their feelings for their land and for the farm. And this is one of the things a lot of people in cities don't understand, is just how emotionally this emotional attachment that comes with farming the land that your dad farmed or your grandfather farmed or that's been in your family since the 1800s. This is something you don't want to lose, that you cherish. And so I think they can be wonderful educators and stewards if they get the proper information about how to grow and practice good agronomy and be good stewards.
Back to the phones now. We have Bruce on the line in Arlington. Hello, Bruce. Bruce, are you with us?
Hi, Chris. Yes.
Hi, go right ahead.
Hi, thanks. I was wondering, I had read a report from the World Bank. It came out about 2006 about global issues that were affecting the world, including like climate change, disease, armed conflict, and like due to water shortages, et cetera. And it kind of all leads back to, I think, the way the economic system we have, where it incentivizes profit over sustainability. So where some governments subsidize certain crops over others. And my question is, do you think it's better in terms of looking at the situation in terms of countries, since countries can have drastically different environments across the landscape? We should be looking at maybe developing communities into like sustainable communities where crops are grown depending on what's native to the area and like utilizing greener technologies. And instead of exporting one monolithic crop, we import crops that aren't able to grow in the area. Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
Boy, Bruce makes a great point. And according to the World Bank, you know, we're already a third of our water withdrawals are unsustainable. And our water demand for agriculture is supposed to double over the next 20 to 30 years. So we're definitely in a water pinch. Now, what he's pointing to, this idea of local farmlands sustaining the cities that surround, you know, that they surround, I think is a wonderful idea, and creating these sort of farm belts that support great cities. I think we're going to need both, though. I mean, as we see, as we've seen the run-up to these wonderful farmers markets that have just blossomed all over the country over the last 20 years, they've been wonderful in that they're providing small farmers who live near cities the ability to get into the business, learn how to grow food, and have a steady market of people who like it, their vegetables incredibly fresh and local. And all that, I think, is important, and I think it will continue. But if you look at the organic market, it's still, you know, it's 4% of our food and beverage sales. It's been growing at double digits for the last 20 years. It's still at 4%, and it's growing fast. It's going to get bigger. But in terms of scale, it's still quite small. And so I think we're going to need both. I don't think we can, you know, countries are going to be able to grow and be completely self-sufficient in food. This idea of food sovereignty and where countries do not depend on global markets, I don't think we have the luxury to do that anymore, just because population growth in some of these countries is so rapid and so high, and demand is so great. China, again, is a classic example. They're not going to go back to eating a meatless diet of the 1960s if they have money in their pockets to buy meat from elsewhere. And so the international market is going to have a role to play. We're all, you know, every farmer who's tilling any bit of land is going to have an important role to play in feeding the planet over the next 20 to 30 years.
I love that at the end of the book you quote someone who recognizes there is no silver bullet approach and advocates what amounts to a silver buckshot approach.
That's right. John Foley, who's at University of Minnesota for many years and led this multinational group who really focused on this problem. And there really is no one solution. We've got a couple of things that we can do. You know, we can close yield gaps in areas around the world that used to be incredibly productive or could be. Places like Ukraine, which used to be the breadbasket of Europe and has just fallen off the map in terms of its agriculture since the fall of the Soviet Union. Sub-Saharan Africa and parts of Latin America have lots of water that they could use to irrigate and do it sustainably if we help them figure out how to do that and help them do that. Aquaculture, we can grow a ton of fish. You know, there are many parts of the ocean that are suitable for agriculture. We can do it without harming the local coastal environment. But we can also cut demand. I mean, and again, it's going to have to be one of these, you know, we're going to have to do all of the above. You know, eating lower on the food chain, stop putting grain in our cars, and help these countries make the demographic transition so that maybe we don't hit 9 or 10 billion people by 2050, that maybe we only hit 8 or 9.
Journalist. Sorry, do you have a final
thought? There are many solutions out there, and we're going to need to put great effort toward all of them.
Journalist Joel K. Bourne, Jr. is a contributing writer for National Geographic and author of the new book, The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. Joel, thank you so much for joining us.
Chris, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker, engineered today by Eric Bright. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones from Jose Carrion. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. The show's email is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.